Hello out there in radio, internet radio land. It's David Mandelbaum speaking to you for New Yiddish Rep Radio Hour. Herzlichen Gruß, Tayre Tziher. I'm very happy to be here tonight with you. And we're going to speak to the star of the Big Bupkis, the Complete Gentiles Guide to Yiddish Vaudeville, Mr. Shane Baker, in a few minutes. Before we do that, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about what's coming up, some exciting things coming up, a little gossip, a little under the table, you know and I know, but nobody else knows. I understand that Avi Hoffman will be performing in New York. He's got a show about Itzik Munger called, it's a show about the life of Itzik Munger, and it features his songs and his poems, and it is absolutely spectacular. And Avi Hoffman is a wonderful, wonderful actor, director. And one of the most moving and satisfying shows in Yiddish that I've ever seen. That'll be coming up in the spring. I understand that Mendy Kahan is coming to town. I don't know what the heck he's going to do, but whatever it is, I urge you to go see it because it will be a lot of fun. A lot of fun you'll go away with a smile on your face. So we've just finished a couple of evenings of the Big Bupkis at the JCC in Manhattan. And I am going to, in a couple of seconds, if we can get a hold of him, speak to Shane Baker, the star of the show. And Shane, are you on the line yet?
So to speak.
How you doing this evening?
All right, more or less. You know, I'm trying to figure out the world and Yiddish vaudeville and entertainment.
One of the things I'd like to ask you about is the book, the publication of the Soviet writers.
Yes.
Could you tell us something about it and what it's about and what it contains and where people can get it?
Sure. The Congress for Jewish Culture has, in the past few months, published a volume called The Biographical Dictionary of Yiddish Writers in the Soviet Union. It's a Yiddish book, 464 pages, 487 entries for different Yiddish writers who worked in the Soviet Union from the October Revolution, which I guess is officially pre-Soviet Union, up until the fall of the Soviet Union. And this is a sort of appendix to our 8-volume Yiddish Biographical Dictionary of Modern Yiddish Literature that was published from the 50s through the 80s. It was compiled by Chaim Bader, a Yiddish writer who worked for many years on Sovetish Heimland there in the Soviet Union, later came to America and worked with us on our journal Zukunft. And this was sort of his life's work. When our 8 volumes were published, it was Grod in the time of the Iron Curtain, and so a lot of important materials about Soviet writers was left out, and Bader knew this. And he dedicated, about 40 years to his work on this appendix. And when he passed away in 2003, we took it upon ourselves to publish it. And Boris Sandler, the editor of the Yiddish Foreword, and Gennady Estreich, a professor of Yiddish at NYU, who had worked under Bader and were protégés of his, and who are now very important to keeping Yiddish culture alive here in America, agreed to edit what Bader had compiled. And they did that. It only took them 6.5, 7 years to get it put together, and now we have it. And it also includes a trilingual dictionary of Soviet Yiddish terms, which is quite handy because a lot of them do not appear in any other location that I know of. For instance, some of the more esoteric and unexpected terms include, like, obrez for a sawed-off shotgun, and pijik for a young reindeer, and, it expands the range of documented Yiddish terms on that level. So,
where can people get it?
Where can people get it? Well, they can get it on Amazon.com or directly from our store, that's CYCO, C-Y-C-O, CYCObooks.org, CYCO Books. It's pronounced CYCO because it's Central Yiddish Cultural Organization, but we call it CYCO for Centrale Yiddische Kulturelle Organizatia.
Right.
That's our book store, and we need your help. What's that?
For a long time, I called it Psycho because.
Well, you know, on some days. Some days.
I hear you. Well, I know you did an extensive. I got to tell you, that thing on New York One was one of the most interesting and it was fascinating, and hilarious at the same time. Frankly, there were times I didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
Well, you and me both. This is our attempt to get the book into the press somehow. Serious Releases garnered one article from Nama Sandrow, whom we know is a dedicated Yiddish cultural activist. And, you know, in the Heuche Fenster, will man nicht wissen von dieser Sache. So Beck Lee, who is a publicist and press agent, said, you know, you can take this. And I had, you know, if I'm honest, I can tell you that I had misgivings about it, but at the same time I said, okay, let's see what can happen. And so what happened was that we got some outraged replies from, like, the Boston Yiddish Radio, who's saying, you know, is this serious? You know, how can you talk about this, talk like this about Yiddish? And then we got a lot of replies from other venues which were saying, like, oh, this is cute, it was funny, it caught my attention. And all of a sudden they were paying attention to Yiddish. I know that the editors were none too happy about this tack, but it did get it to New York One and sold a few copies, believe it or not.
Tell folks who might not be familiar what exactly you did.
We made a thing about how, you know, this book, we couldn't sell it, so we would see if people would take it, or if we could leave it in certain locations, and what would happen. So we tried the Port Authority bus terminal, and this I felt particularly bad about. We said, you know, they said, try setting it on the ground. And I said, we can't do that. But I, you know, ultimately we did try it, and people stepped on it. And it was, you know, now I'm talking about, are certain venues okay for Yiddish? But, you know, they walked right over it. So anyway, that an end was put to that because they threw us out of the Port Authority bus terminal. because you're not allowed to record there, and they said, you know, this is sacrilegious because they thought it was a Torah, and not knowing a Yiddish book from a anyway. So then we wound up on the High Line with New York One trying to give it away, and actually there were some conversation. A lot of people just walked on by because, you know, they assume it's some kind of come on whatever. But some people actually stopped and talked about it. And finally, we found a woman who knew the history of these writers and was quite fascinated with it and took it. But until then, it was a rather depressing take on, you know, what Yiddish means to most people today and, you know, where it really stands in the bigger picture.
Well, You did a show on NPR, which had the dual purpose of raising money for NPR and publicizing the Big Bupkis.
Oh, WBAI.
Yeah, WBAI. Is that different than NPR? Is that not an NPR?
Yes, very much so. They have no corporate sponsorship. They're like our little radio station here. No corporate sponsorship.
I see.
NPR takes money from the corporations.
I see.
BAI does not. It is strictly viewer-supported and from the grant of this man who wanted to have pacifist Pacifica radio.
That's wonderful. Well, first of all, I got to tell you, you were terrific on that show.
I mean, should only raise money for our little station.
But you were, and it seemed to go very well. It seemed like you did sell some copies of the work. But what I found fascinating was the range of subject matter that these people wrote about. Could you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that
sure. I mean, probably people who are listening to our little radio hour are familiar with writers like Peretz Markish and David Hofstein, great poets and prose writers and their works, but you know, in those 487 entries, we also have playwrights, we have botanical and economic textbooks that were composed in Yiddish for schools where the course of study, the Unterrichtssprache, as we say, was Yiddish. There is also a poet mentioned there named David Eisenwarg, who I don't believe he ever actually published a volume of his own, and his only published works were maybe in journals or newspapers that are pretty much lost, but Bader found out about the guy. He was killed in a submarine attack in World War II, fighting against the Germans, but Bader found out about him when reading something by Hofstein, and Hofstein said, oh, there's a very promising young writer, David Eisenwarg. And from that, he saw, oh, there's some writer I don't know, and he looked around and searched and found the guy's picture and was able to make a biography of him.
It's really fascinating. I understand that there are works about physics as well, scientific works
it really spans the gamut. We mention those as a kind of comic take on, you know, a botanical textbook in Yiddish, a physics textbook in Yiddish. But the fact is that, you know, this shows the breadth of the Yiddish language and that you really can do anything in Yiddish. I mean, there was a time, but not everyone has the full vocabulary at this point in time, unfortunately. It's like Markish's poem, which is really about the Holocaust, but has become the motto for it's become the motto for Soviet Yiddish poetry. It could well be a motto for Yiddish itself, you know, Brochsticke. And he's trying to put the pieces together of this shattered mirror, the Spiegel auf der Stein. He's trying to put them together. His fingers are bleeding like hell, and he sees that, you know, it's spread over the seven seas. There was a completeness at some point, but you go crazy trying to put it all back together. That doesn't mean that you stop trying to put it back together, though.
Shane, I want to, you know, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, and I want to bring it up now. To hear you talk about Yiddish, the language and the culture and the literature, you have such an obvious love, a deep love for it, a deep appreciation for it. And you come to it from where from? This wasn't a part of your upbringing. It isn't a part of your background. But you have such an obvious feeling for it, such a deep connection to it. What about it moves you? What about it got you like that?
Well, you know, my initial attraction was to the humorous side of things. I mean, that's just how things happen in America or whatever. And I heard some comic words when I was a kid, fine. But I also had a great interest in the theater, and I saw from early on that Yiddish theater has this huge influence on the world and the American stages, Stella Adler being one major link. And here in New York, I came across the book On Stage, Off Stage by Lyuba Cadison and Joe Bulov, and I thought that the way they wrote about Yiddish theater and the way they wrote about their feelings for theater and what they did to work in Yiddish, it was to me the most moving and passionate writing about theater in general that I had seen since I read Meyerhold's Notebooks in college. And you know, when I see someone has a passion for something, that interests me and fascinates me, and they were able to communicate that to me in that book with their letters, and it gave me a real feeling for it. And later, you know, as I learned the language, I got to know the people who people dedicate their lives and fight their whole lives for this language. And you know, there are so many aspects to it, but in the secular Yiddish culture and in Yiddish theater, there are people who are inside and outside, and there are the donors who really keep it going, and there are the people who are involved in it directly, nitty-gritty, and then there's the audience outside who comes in from time to time. And the fact is that a lot of the people who are there and right in the nitty-gritty of it are not in it, you know, because they're going to make a lot of money at it. They're in it because they love something, and I guess that passion kind of went over to me. Bulov, when he was playing Death of a Salesman in Argentina, and I think it's in 49, like almost as soon as it was up on Broadway, they started working on their Yiddish version of it. Writes this very, it's a beautiful but galling and sad letter to Lyuba, who was here in New York, and he's writing to her and he's complaining about, you know, I make money on the English stage in Oklahoma, which he played for the full run. He hated it the whole time. He was backstage writing a Yiddish novel, and then he'd go out and he'd do Ali Haykam, and then he'd go back and he would have, you know, he would never watch it. He hated the show. But it paid for their apartment on 67th Street.
Who did he play? Tell us who he played in the show.
He played Ali Haykam, the Persian peddler.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. And so he did that, and he couldn't stand it, but he made money at it. And he writes from Argentina. He says, you know, I'm down here. They don't have the right lights. They don't have this. They don't have that. I have to put everything together myself. We're losing money. He says, I make money on the English stage, and I throw it away on the Yiddish stage. So why did he do that? Because it was inside him. He had to do it. He felt it. And somehow that drive, you know, what people will do for this language is I don't know. I felt it myself. And then, so, you know, I got to know Mina Bern, who played her whole life in it. I got to know Lyuba herself. And the deep passion that's there, I got it too, somehow.
And,
I don't know. It's a very strange thing. Shakespeare says, the sight of lovers feedeth those in love. So, you know, it it just affected me how deeply people feel about this language and culture. And also, you know, Lebedev sings, "As man versucht uns ist gut, will sich noch einmal." And the more that I got to know Yiddish language and the culture and the writers, the more I have fallen in love with it, you know, of my own accord, as someone who likes good quality material.
I'm curious to ask you about this because, you know, I've heard you talk about Johnny Abrams a lot and how you go to him with questions. And the interesting thing is that you cannot appreciate Yiddish culture without some appreciation of the religion, of the religious traditions of the... It's so much an ingrained part of the culture. And I know you went to Johnny whenever you had questions. Could you talk a little bit about Johnny and how he helped you understand that aspect of Yiddish culture and Yiddish literature and language?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a few people that helped with that. And Reb Johnny was... a big one. I mean, because he had such a broad grasp of things. I think the term for him is a bucky, right? There's someone who really knows his way around the whole thing and has heard it all at least once and has a rough idea where you can find it. And that may be a minimal description of a bucky and what Reb Johnny was, but. Yeah, you know, I come from Protestants, good Middle Western Protestant stock, and I went to a Lutheran grade school, so I was raised Episcopalian, and they were pretty strict, and we had to, you know, we had a class in Bible every day, a Bible being for us both Tanakh and the Bris Chadasha, and. But that's
the Old Testament and the New Testament for those of you.
So to speak. But these were devout Protestants who, you know, insisted on a lot of study of the Jewish Bible. Actually, not fully the Jewish Bible, because there are certain books of the Jewish Bible that were not taken or canonized for the Protestant Bible, like the Maccabi and these other things. But so I know a little bit about biblical history from that, and have an appreciation for it, and found it important for my study of Shakespeare and other things. My undergraduate degree was in English Lit in English Lit, let's say. So coming to Yiddish literature, it became clear early on, you know, in my studies, that here are these citations from the Talmud and things, and I know Bible, but I don't know Talmud. And it was interesting to me that the teachers in the various programs, you know, these people who really know Yiddish and come from a secular Yiddish background, you know, they know that this comes from Talmud, but they don't really talk about it. And, you know, they say this is a Talmudic citation, but they're talking about the everyday life of Eastern European Jews and how that's reflected in this thing. But I'm saying to myself, from a literary aspect, don't you want to know also, you know, about this passage from Talmud, where it comes from, what it means, why the writer has chosen to use it at this particular point? And no one ever talks about that I can recall. That doesn't mean that there aren't people who've talked about it, but no one talked about it that I heard or that I saw in my studies. And this came up as I started to work with recitations, and you know, I got hooked up. I don't even know how it happened that I wound up going out to corporate Raiders and got to know John. Oh, through Yossel Weiss. Through Yossel Weiss, I got to know Rep Johnny. I guess it was Yossel who hooked me up with that group and got me to, I don't know how, to go out to corporate Raiders there in Brooklyn. And I was also proofreading some for the Allgemeine Journal. And, you know, getting more interested in the Ivre and the Loshen Koidish side of things, which I've never studied. But, yeah, so I was working on recitations. I had the Golden Cape from Peretz. And there's heavy, heavy stuff in there where they're talking about what happens on Shabbos. And the souls are released from torture in hell. Apparently there's even, you know, Shabbos is respected even in hell. And the Pekdoinis Lach that are released and allowed to travel back to the earth. And have to. So I didn't know what any of this meant. And I had to sit down with Johnny and go through with him. And he explained to me, you know, about the what's going on here and these different views of, you know, how you can describe God, how you cannot describe God, like a person, not like a person, and I think there's some, you know, I'd have to be looking at my notes to understand, but the fact is that to really read this literature, you really need to be going into what the religious tradition is that the writers are drawing upon, because that is the literature that they knew. Yes, they know world literature too, and they draw on that, but beaten into them literally from Kinvise on is this religious tradition that provides a very rich background for understanding what they're saying. And I'm trying to write about that a little bit for what's happening in Beshevis. I've got a Leyen Kreis, a reading circle at the Workman's Circle going on right now. And what we're doing is reading Peretz, Yud Lamed Peretz. We read Monish already, and now we're reading the Taivetz Kleider. And now we're going to read a couple of stories by Beshevis. And what is going to be shown is that in these two stories, the Spiegel by Beshevis and Maisa Tishevitz, so that's the mirror and the last demon, they're translated to in English. First, the English translations are in some ways stripped of Yiddishkeit to make them digestible and understandable to, I guess, Jews who don't know Yiddish and therefore are probably not going to know the religious tradition too well. To make them accessible to a broader Gentile audience that will have no idea about any of this. So, and maybe to make the job easier for the translator. Anyway, but also to see that Beshevis has this interplay with Peretz, where he's taking themes that Peretz covers and reworking them in his own way and throwing in his own, you know, spin on the Gemara and the Talmud and hell and heaven and what happens, you know, what happens to these, what happens to Jews who sin. Anyway, I don't know if that answers your question, but there are people you can go to, but Johnny is someone whom I knew and was comfortable calling up and he could say, this guy could have done a lot for Yiddish literature if he were still around, because he had a grasp of world literature and also just that beautiful grasp of the real Jewish tradition. And that's not to say there aren't other people who can do that today, but I don't know them too well right now.
Well,
at the same time, it's not true. You know, over there at Cholent, there's a lot of guys who know exactly what you're talking about when you throw out a citation. And thank God, you know, there was a librarian in Texas, a frustrated Roth. He wanted to become a rabbi. His father didn't have the money to pay for the schar limit, so he could become, you know, so he could go for rabbinic studies. He became a Jewish librarian, and even worse, a Jewish librarian in Austin, Texas. But he knew a little bit. He was somewhat knowledgeable. Nathan Snyder, and now there's a little Jewish library there under his name. And he was a great, great friend of mine. And he taught me a way around things that made life much easier. The Otzar HaHachomim. The Otzar HaHachomim is a Talmudic concordance. You know, it's like Brown Driver Briggs for Tanakh. This is for the Talmud. And that helped me. But now you've got Google.
Right.
And Google will take you right to the citations that you want. But that doesn't mean that you're going to get everything just reading it. You really need someone like me. I need to talk to someone who studied it before I can be sure what's really being said.
Shane, tell us, please, don't let it go by the wayside. Tell us about the Lane Christ, where, when, how people can subscribe to it.
Oh, this is Mondays at 5 p.m., and it'll go, you know, I don't know, as long as people can stand it. It's a partnership between the Congress for Jewish Culture and the Workman's Circle. And Moshe Rosenfeld was assigned the task of bringing people into the Workman's Circle. So he called me up and asked me to run this Lehenkreis. And the Workman's Circle, you know, wanting to make it as broad as possible, said, you know, well, maybe you want to do it in translation. And the translation class in English got one student, and the Yiddish class got five. So it's become one class in Yiddish, and we read it in Yiddish. We discuss in whatever language people want to talk in. You know, they can talk Russian, but no one else is going to understand, preferably in Yiddish or in English. But we won't say you can speak Pig Latin, too. We don't care. Just read in Yiddish, and we discuss. And Monday's at 5 p.m., and I think it's there's some fee. I think it's $12 a session, but it's cheaper if you're a member of one of the organizations. It's $5, and I don't think they're so strict about collecting. Don't tell them I said that, but let's be fair. And it could be interesting. It could be interesting. We're always happy to have someone else who knows the language and can read. And unlike a lot of Lehenkreis, you know, in Stama Lehenkreis, you read it cold. But I've tried to take a tack of saying, you know, you're going to read this page next week, you'll read this page next week, so that people can prepare the vocabulary, and maybe if there's a difficult custom or something that's covered, maybe they want to research that and talk about it. They're not obligated to, but, you know, that way you don't feel like, you know, these words I don't know, because there is a bissel shvere ivri in some of the stuff. And
there can be difficult places. Peretz himself was brought up in an extremely orthodox background, and he was an Eloi. He was considered a prodigy as a child. And
this is why we love the poem Manish, because it's got autobiographical aspects as well. But yeah.
Well, let's let people know, where is the Workman's Circle, and
I think it's at 347 West 37th Street between 8th and 9th. But you can look it up, circle.org online.
And I urge you all to do so and attend Shane's Lehenkreis's reading circle. Don't be put off by Yiddish. Go down there. Don't be put off by it. Go down there because you remember that your grandmother, you spoke to your grandmother or your grandfather or an uncle or an aunt, and maybe you won't understand every word, but go down there and just absorb the sound of it.
And it can't hurt you to hear it, you know.
I think part of what you have expressed to me is how wonderful not only the sound of it, the flow of the language, but how there are things you can express in Yiddish that are difficult to express in any other language, that are so unique to the culture and to the gestalt of the people in the culture. I want to now talk a little bit about, you know, enough of the self patting on the back. What about the big bupkis?
Enough with the self-patting on the back. I'm not going to pat myself on the back about the big bupkis. We sold out two shows, the whole theater, packed to the rafters, at the Jewish Community Center in Manhattan. There wasn't an extra seat in the house.
There was not.
People are dying for people are dying for some good Jewish humor, and we even snuck in a little bit of Jewish literary value as well.
That is very true, and some of Bulov's Wortkunst snuck in there. And tell me, how, you know, you had this big article, this big profile in the New York Times about yourself, which I was privileged to be mentioned in, and at the Hebrew Actors Union on 7th Street. So now I want to talk a little bit about your hopes for Yiddish culture and the future of Yiddish theater. Can you tell me what do you see in the future? What are your hopes for the future? And be realistic. Talk and tish. You know, don't paint the rosy picture. Tell it like it is. What do you think?
Well, I'm of two minds. I mean, one mind is that it's very difficult, as you know, David. I mean, we have these discussions all the time. From one side, you know, it's so hard to find financial support to put things up properly as we really want to. And it's, you know, it's a kimpton mit blit.
Yeah.
It's not easy to keep this going. On the other hand, you know, it's too beautiful to let go. And maybe, maybe if we keep with things, maybe other people will, as we have, be inspired by the passion that is out there for it, and begin to see that, on the theater side, let's just talk about theater for a second, that we need to have a strong repertory theater that keeps alive the real Yiddish repertoire and plays it throughout the year and can show, you know, that, hey, we've got a beautiful theatrical tradition, and let's keep it going so that we can drop in sometimes and see, oh yeah, this is the Yiddish take on how things happen in the world, on how people relate to each other, and how people should relate to each other, and how people might relate to each other. And to keep that available, because expressed in any other language than Yiddish, you don't get the full thing. You don't get the real picture. Then at the same time, you know, this theater should be able to create new works and to look for new horizons, because there's a lot of creativity that is still left, that's still left, that's inspired, you know, by these people who are drawn to the language. Our company being one example. I mean, you look at the musical tradition, it's out there. You know, musicians come in and they find a whole new world, and you get someone like Michael Vinograd, who just, you know, will knock your socks off with his performances, or Zoe Korolenko, or Sarah Gordon, or, you know, the list goes on and on, and I'm sorry if I leave people out, Jake Schulman-Ment, Eve Sicula, all of these people who are then inspired by what they find to take it a step further and answer it in their own way, you know. So there's a rich tradition, and there's a rich future in it. And we need to have a place that is providing a venue for all of these people to not only reenact the traditions that they have received, but also to bring them forward, you know, the famous Jewish search for a usable past. We also need to have a steady company that people can hook into, where they can work on their Yiddish, so they're not just learning it from a transliterated script, but where they're performing a language that they are working on for themselves, that they want to get into their bones. Because a noch gemachter Yiddish, it's not a Yiddish, okay? We've all heard that on the stage. Someone was a brechtet zainer, was breaking his teeth. Or the viruschke flakes off, retzi mit a hesa kartoffel in moil. So they're talking like they have a hot potato in their mouth. And that's Yiddish because, you know, as be Yiddish, you know, they put them up there. That this is not what we need to have. We need
is
to,
this is a Yiddish version of Demosthenes. You know, instead of holding three rocks in your mouth, you bite into a hot potato.
Yeah. So it happens, and we want the respect and the love for the language to be up there among the actors. You know, we had a young guy who played with the big Bobkas there. I think my credentials are there, even though, you know, I push the limits of good taste at times. But we had a young guy up there who he heard Sidor Belarski, and I still don't know his full story. I got to have coffee with him. You know, he's a young African American man. He's I think he's a ger. I think he's you know, become a Jew, and he's the life partner of the Hillel Rabbi at Sarah Lawrence. Very earnest young guy, fell in love with the music of Sidor Belarski and began to study it. And he's not hooked into the broader Yiddish world, but he's been studying the diction. And from performance to performance, he's you know, he wasn't chopped liver to begin with. But we heard him in January at the Shalom Aleichem Center. And he'd written to me because of an article that appeared in the AP. And I saw his YouTube thing. I thought, this is a joke. He's lip-syncing Sidor Belarski because it was low-quality video. And then I heard him, and I almost fell out of my chair. The guy is like a serious, you know, this guy means it. And now we had him in the show. This is someone that you can work with.
Yes, yes, yes. It's you know, it's such a. You were talking about corporate raiders before. Corporate raiders is the forerunner of Cholent. And in terms of your exposure to Yiddish and Yiddish culture, how would you rate Cholent? What could you say about Cholent so people out there listening could.
I should be more dedicated to Cholent, and I should have appreciated it more while it was in Manhattan, which is not to say that it won't be further, but who knows what's happening with it. I should have spent a lot more time there with Reb Johnny. This is what I will say. But in the future, I need to spend more time there with Reb Yitzchak and with all of these other people, because this is a chance for... you know, this is for people who are looking for connections to Yiddishkeit, to the broader world, and it can serve as a nexus for these things. I think that a lot of things are coming out of it. That like this Yiddish farm, I think, you know, you look around, you see a lot of the same faces all of a sudden. And Because that real blossoming of Yiddish culture came out of people who were questioning the religious tradition and staying in or leaving it or, you know, or maintaining things to a certain degree. And after, you know, a few generations now, what we have is some assimilation where there's, you know, not as much connection to the Yiddish tradition. But with Cholent, it's like a blossom. I'm not going to say it's the new Haskola, that's a lot hidden, but it is a place where you know, the people with the religious background are looking for broader ways to express themselves, and it can be a new, there can be some, you know, if it's a manifestation, if it's a venue, if it's a cause, I don't know, but it's a place where there is a chance for this growth and flowering of culture.
Before we're getting towards the end of our hour, but before we go, could you talk about the Congress for Jewish Culture, its history, its mission, and what your hopes for it are in the future? You're the executive director and have been so for quite a number of years.
Make sure you say director.
Director. Tell us.
Yeah, the Congress for Jewish Culture is it's 65 years old now. It was put together in 47, I think, founded in 47, incorporated in 1948, and it was a a post-Holocaust attempt by various Jewish organizations to create a sort of umbrella organization that would support Yiddish culture. And at the time, it was considered really a full-spectrum organization because we covered the whole political spectrum from socialists to Bundists, it was considered very broad, but we didn't include communists. Now, what has happened with the organization is that it has become a sort of central Yiddish publishing location. I think we publish more Yiddish books and journals than any other single organization. But we're fighting for our existence because, what can I say, over time we've suffered from that assimilation, you know, that post-war generation of immigrants who sent their children to Camp Hemshech and to Boyberik, and the kids have some, you know, fond memories of Yiddish, but it's not life for them, and it's something where they get together once a year, maybe at the Shtein, at our memorial in Riverside Park, and the Ginnuk Shoin, maybe they go to a Yiddish play once a year at the big Yiddish theater. But to get them into a real Yiddish event, it's hard to...
at the risk of opening a Pandora's box, What do you view as the difference between the Congress for Jewish Culture and the National Yiddish Book Center?
Well, the National Yiddish Book Center is taking what we put blood, sweat, and tears into for many, many years and republishing that and making it available online. But, you know, we're creating new material in Yiddish. We are putting out new things in Yiddish. We are continuing the Yiddish tradition. They're looking backwards, and we're looking forwards. And, you know, they feel like all of that is Hefka material because they, for instance, took our books and republished them without our permission, and wouldn't respond to us when we pointed out that we still had things in copyright, you know, that we still had copies of these books. So, you know, it's a very valuable thing because they've put these books up there, but now I guess we're Esav and they are Yankov because they knew how to get the blessing from people, you know, and they raised the big money, but out there. We've been out there for years, and we're still doing our thing, but it's become very difficult. For instance, sales for the Tsiko, for our bookstore, have fallen to half of the worst year. Last year, we sold $5,000 worth of Yiddish books, because all of a sudden, Yiddish books are available for free online, you know? And that's a great thing for availability and all that, but it's become more difficult for us, and maybe there's no need to have a bookstore where you can go in and speak to the Kramer, to whoever's running the store in Yiddish, and they can advise you on what's the Yiddish book you might want to read or whatever. Maybe it's past that time, and maybe New York does not need to have a physical location where you go in and you can buy a copy of Chaim Grade, a copy of Yankov Gladstein, and talk to the people about, in Yiddish, about what the book is and what it means and what's happening. Maybe it's beyond that. I don't know.
Tell me, how are... This brings up an interesting issue, and we probably don't have enough time to really get into it deeply, but how are institutions like YIVO, how can they help, and how are they not helping?
Well, you know, since the new director at YIVO is there, Jonathan Brent, we've had really the first opportunities to co-sponsor things with them and use that space over there, and that's very good and very important for us. You know, the Soviet Writers Memorial we've done there, the New Yiddish Rep did Shylock there, and...
But we've been 86th since then, haven't we?
Well, maybe. You see, the thing is, it's a tricky thing. There's supposed to be this collaboration, but the lifeboat is getting smaller, and the fight for resources is more desperate, and so people are willing to work together as long as it doesn't cut into the money that supports their institution. And this is, you know, it's the self-preservation of the institution, fiduciary responsibility, and all of that. But, you know, my mentor at UT Texas, Bob King, talked about this. He's worked with endangered languages before. And Yiddish, although it's a growing language, you know, on the secular side, it is an endangered language, we can safely say. And the Yiddish institutions, I think that there is among us a lot of fear, because we're seeing that resources are not necessarily growing, that they're shrinking. And, you know, with the way the economy is right now, to get a donation from someone is...
It's
difficult. And we're fighting, and so we learn to make do with less. We have to, because we're going to do it, come hell or high water. But the people who are out there have to ask themselves, you know, what is it worth to me? And I'm afraid a lot of people are not going to, quote-unquote, miss the water until the well runs dry.
Shane, I can't tell you how important it is to have talked to you for the past hour, and how eloquent the depth of feeling you have shown for Yiddish and Yiddish culture reads to me, and I'm sure to anyone who listens to this interview. What is your hope? What is your best hope for Yiddish culture?
You know, there was a time when I fought the idea of a Yiddish house, because we felt like all the organizations, but it would be nice to see the big institutions get together and save the Hebrew Actors Union and make that a center for Yiddish culture here in New York, for living Yiddish culture, where you know, New Yiddish Rep, or the Yiddish National Theater, or the National Yiddish Theater, or all of us together can work together and present programming for the Congress and the League for Yiddish and the others. I'd like to see something happening in Yiddish every night there. I'd like to see a Yiddish cafe and a reading room. And the fact is, office space, we don't need so much these days, right? We just need a computer.
Yes. Well, that's true.
I'd like to see something central and something that can be taken out and moved to other locations, to Brooklyn, to Philadelphia, to Florida, to Toronto, to Istanbul, wherever they need some Yiddish. But I think this is what we need to hope for. And I hope that the Cotton Cap get together and decide to do this while there's still some drive and interest for things. I know that you feel there's a lot of promise and push in this Yiddish farm. I don't know enough about it because, I'll be frank with you, I was sent to scout camp as a child, and I don't go willingly into the woods ever since. But this is my hopes for city life with Yiddish.
Well, Shane, I want to thank you for spending the time with us. I know it's is it Academy Award night tonight? Is that?
Yeah, I'm going to go see that happen with some people. You know.
It's yeah. Well, you know, it's. I can't tell you how inspiring it is to hear your impassioned thoughts about Yiddish, about Yiddish culture, and people. The Big Bupkis will go on. We will certainly keep performing it and keep honing it and keep. Shane, of course, has become synonymous with Yiddish vaudeville.
I have the blessing of Fivish Finkel now.
that's right. And I really want to thank you, Shane, so much. It's been a wonderful, wonderful hour. It seems to have flown by. I really don't know where the time went. But we'll put this up on our website at newyiddishrep.org. And keep on trucking, folks. Keep on supporting us in our endeavors. And Shane...
Look, David, you have to keep going. We need a place where we can perform in Yiddish.
Thank you. Please go to all the programs from the Workman's Circle to the Congress for Yiddish Culture, Cafe Hoys.
Speaking of which, I need to talk to you about Brooklyn because we want to bring Basia and Avi to Brooklyn with the Itzik Manga leader.
Absolutely, no problem.
Keep your dials tuned, folks, and read up at newyiddishrep.org and congressforjewishculture.org and Workman's Circle, because we've got a lot of interesting things going on.
And even the Volksbühne.
That's right.
Dare I say... Even the Volksbühne, which is going to come up with some, Brian Wasserman is going to come up with some very interesting programming going forward. So thanks for being here. Shane, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your participation tonight. Okay. Take care. Okay. Don, are we still on the air? We must be because Don, I got you to say something. I want to tell people, if you want to broadcast on internet radio, bbsradio.com is the place to go. These are wonderful people, and hopefully in the future we will be able to offer you a video so that you can see actual performances in real time, live, of Yiddish Theater. Paradise, California is the place to be on the internet, in internet broadcasting. And I want to thank Don and Doug for their wonderful support. And I don't know what else to say.
Wow, thank you very much. We appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay, Don. Take care.